BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Sometimes stories have to be quarried slowly out of unpromising bare rock. Sometimes they explode out at you. Usually that means you have very little time to get them right. During the first Gulf War, I was in Baghdad when it was being bombed by the Americans and the British. One morning, it was the 13th of February 1991, I came out of my hotel room to see my friend Marie Colvin of the Sunday Times striding down the corridor. "Have you heard?" she said, without breaking step. "They've hit an air raid shelter." We rushed to the place, a suburb called Amaria, to report the story. That meant watching burnt bodies and fragments of bodies, body parts being pulled out, and talking to the devastated fathers and husbands who'd left their wives, their families in the shelter overnight, thinking, hoping that they'd be safe.
"The bomb or missile went through a reinforced concrete roof at least a yard thick. The Iraqis say the attack happened at about 4 o'clock this morning."
The Americans killed at least 408 civilians in that raid. For me, as a young reporter, I'd turned 31 a few days earlier, it was a challenge. In Washington and London, they claimed, wrongly, that it was a military command center. The American and British spin machine swung into action to discredit reporters like me.
"Military commanders remain convinced that the Baghdad bunker hit last night was a military..."
I was asked some tough questions on air.
"Is it possible to say with certainty that it was never a military..."
The Americans were saying there's no question but that it was a military bunker.
"Well, Mike, I've got no evidence that it was a military target. I saw no communications dishes. I saw no aerials."
Gung-ho newspapers in Fleet Street said I was inexperienced and compared me to Lord Haw-Haw, the nickname of William Joyce, executed by Britain for treason in 1946 for broadcasting Nazi propaganda from Berlin. It was uncomfortable. But I knew my sources were solid, my own eyes and ears. As often happens in journalism, someone's tragedy was my good fortune. I was tested, didn't screw up, and my bosses noticed. Is there a story you're most proud of?
I guess I'm going to say the Harvey Weinstein story.
Dean Baquet was executive editor of the New York Times when its investigation led to the conviction of the film producer Harvey Weinstein for rape and sexual assault.
"Harvey Weinstein has been sentenced to 23 years in prison."
"This is what justice looks like.
A Me Too message, especially to men of power."
Harvey Weinstein, like many before him, behaved as if his wealth and power bestowed impunity. Very wealthy man, squads of lawyers. Mm-hmm. Threatening to sue.
And Harvey Weinstein was an advertiser at the New York Times, by the way.
What should journalists do in that situation?
You should treat them the way you treat people with less power.
In these programs, I'm taking you to some of the most difficult stories I've had to report and to the obstacles that stand between journalists and the truth. In this episode, journalists need contacts and connections. Sometimes they want to blow the whistle to stop something bad. Sometimes they want to discredit an enemy. Sometimes they believe their power can close a story down.
When Harvey Weinstein called me up and said he wanted to talk about the story off the record, I said, absolutely not. I don't want to have a special relationship with you where you think you can call your peer. You talk to the reporters. I have applied that rule to governors, to presidents. Don't even let them in the door. They're luring you into a little world, and they're closing the door. And essentially, they're saying, in the case of Harvey Weinstein, we are two powerful men, and we understand these things, don't we? And I didn't even want the foot to get in the door. The moment you open that door of treating a powerful person differently, the moment you open that door, you're doomed.
This is Frontlines of Journalism, Episode 7, Open the Door. And you're doomed.
Do you miss not being a daily journalist anymore?
I have the occasional pang, but broadly speaking, no, I don't.
Laura Koonsberg was political editor of the BBC for 7 years. Now she presents the BBC's Sunday morning political talk show.
Of course, there's a buzz from being right in the middle of things. That is exciting. But I have done it for long enough. It is wonderful now to have a bit more time to think about things.
It was a tumultuous time in British politics, and journalism was changing too. One of the reasons was an app.
The sort of advent of the WhatsApp group and politics being done by WhatsApp speeded everything up. So during the days of the May cabinet, Tuesday morning, get to about 10:30, the cabinet meeting itself would be winding up. I would get WhatsApps about what had just happened from cabinet without even asking for them. Get the kind of Remainer camp going, ba, 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 Brexit tears, we socked it to them kind of thing. You get the rival one saying, pretty made that point, so-and-so and so-and-so, good one for us. So not quite in real time, but almost in real time, a sort of artificial reportage from both sides.
Because you trust them?
No, not completely. Of course not. In political journalism, you would never trust anybody's account of things completely. But it would give you a germ of something. I actually think it means that the politicians and the sort of spin machines, they have much less control. And I think sometimes people get that inside out. They think now, oh, it's more spun than ever before. Actually, it's far more easy for people to get information out now because every politician's walking around with, you know, basically a bomb in their pocket.
The WhatsApp effect goes way beyond Westminster. In Gaza, it's reached the BBC producer, Rushdie Abu Alouf.
I receive 3,000 to 4,000 WhatsApp messages every day.
How does that change your job as a journalist, apart from the fact that your WhatsApp timeline sounds like a complete nightmare?
Yeah, it's getting easier to get the information, but it's getting harder to verify them. Journalism don't rely on WhatsApp messages. They can give you an impression about something is happening there, but you have to do your own job of checking the information.
You must, in every case, be testing stuff and never take anything at face value. We know sometimes people would put things into a WhatsApp group, and you could tell by the tone of it, they're doing that completely deliberately, so it then gets leaked and makes a story. Nothing compares to asking your own questions.
At fraught moments, a sense of crisis can sweep away that useful suspicion.
Evidence from intelligence sources reveal that Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda.
I talked about it to Dean Baquet of the New York Times. After the 2003 invasion of Iraq, there was quite a bit of soul-searching among journalists who felt that they'd been given briefings which really weren't true. Right. Or were so ridiculously spun, weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they swallowed it basically naively and wrote this stuff up.
Yeah. I think something happened during the war on terror. Journalists got more patriotic. And there was panic. And I think it made us susceptible to those kinds of conversations that led to our misreporting in Iraq. I think there was a sense during the buildup that everybody was on the same side. So yes, period has made me more reflective and more questioning when everybody goes in lockstep in one direction. I don't go off the record with public officials or powerful people. I never met President Obama, partly because presidents like people to come over and chat off the record, and I wouldn't do that. Here would have been my nightmare. Let's say I had dinner Monday night with the president when I was running the Washington Bureau. And the next day, the chief White House correspondent comes in to me and says, I hear you had dinner with the president. What did you guys talk about? Can you imagine my saying to him, I can't tell you? I think I would have like gone up to the bathroom and thrown up. I can't tell you? So I don't want to hear anything as the editor, that would cause me to say to a reporter, I can't tell you.
Dean accepts it's different for reporters trying to build relationships.
As I understand it, never having worked at Westminster, briefings as well as WhatsApp gossip is a big part of it.
Yeah.
Laura Koonsberg.
Briefing and off-the-record conversations are a huge part of it. The government in the UK runs off a basis of collective responsibility, which means that people on the government payroll are not able always to say what they think or where they've had disagreements. So if you want to find out what's really gone on, you have to hear those things off the record.
What if you get friendly with them, though?
Well, I never did get friendly with people. I mean, you have working relationships with people. Going to an event where there are politicians who might tell you something that is useful for your audience and helpful to your reporting is not the same as going out on the tiles for fun. I don't think it's difficult to make that distinction. I'm not worried about making people who are in politics cross because my job is not to make them cross or happy. My job is to find out information for people who are watching at home. What we do is important. and I believe in it.
As a myself, as a reporter of many years, I don't want to get to know people on a personal level.
Part of it was my background. My background made me feel like the best journalists are a little bit outside looking in. The very act of reporting is that you're outside looking in, right? I think you lose that if you really become part of the power structure. Then you're sort of, frankly, you're on the inside looking out. And that's not a very good position to be in for as a journalist.
I agree, unlike Piers Morgan. You called your book The Insider. You speak about staggering access to the corridors of power. You said that, for example, with Blair, when you were editing The Mirror, you had 22 lunches, 8 dinners, 6 interviews, 24 one-on-ones over tea and biscuits, and numerous phone calls with the Prime Minister. On the front page of your book, there's Cherie, Mrs. Blair, fixing your tie while Tony looks on approvingly. Isn't it better to be outside the tent looking in
Being inside the tent, but it depends then what you do with your position.
But he must have told you loads of things which you didn't report.
Yes, but he also informed me about stuff which was very useful as a newspaper editor to inform my readers about. But more importantly, when it actually came to an issue like the Iraq War, I listened to him, I heard all his pleas, and then I completely ignored them and went the other way.
What about that subliminal influence that even though consciously you might be doing that, the fact is that you're breathing the same air, operating in the same circles, that can just make you trim a bit?
It can to, I think, people who are weak-minded. And I think whatever people think of me, I would find it hard for them to think I'm not an independent-minded thinker. Now, do I like being the insider? Yeah, I like hanging out with rich, famous, powerful people, but not to the point where it would stop me running a story which they may not like. How do most scoops get broken? They get broken either by whistleblowers or by journalists building up great contacts.
Contacts and sources aren't just the rich and powerful. They can be anyone, and anyone can lie. The New York Times produced a podcast during the war against the jihadists of Islamic State, also known as ISIS. Much of it was based on a series of interviews with a Canadian source who said, on the record, that he joined Islamic State as a volunteer and gone to fight in Syria.
It's a man standing in the desert.
Anything that could help her answer the question, why did people join ISIS?
He's clad in black.
The podcast, which was called Caliphate, was a big hit.
Here to accept the Peabody Award.
And then it turned out.
The New York Times says it's found significant falsehoods in its blockbuster podcast.
That the source had made most of it up. You know, I listened to that podcast. And, I've spent years reporting from the Middle East, and I thought, my God, that's incredible. The access that they've got, that is an amazing story. And a Lebanese colleague of mine working for the BBC said, you know, I don't buy it. I said, what? It's the New York Times that had checked all that stuff, for God's sake. So when it all unraveled, I was actually, I'll be honest with you, I was quite shocked.
So was I. we screwed up.
Caliphate is a cautionary tale. I admired what I thought was good reporting. I wanted it to be true. Sometimes you don't want stories to be true. Next time...
I did a very short story for the Times, acutely conscious that A, I thought, this sounds so horrific, I can't believe it's true, and B, this is a dream story for the far right. And so it proved.
Rotherham and the grooming gangs. Frontlines of Journalism is presented by me, Jeremy Bowen. The producer is Georgia Catt. The assistant producer is Sam Peach. Additional research by Rob Byrne. Series mixing by Jackie Marjoram. The series editor is Philip Sellers. Please rate and leave a review to help others find us.
1, 2, 1.
Aye, that's working.
What would happen if you tried to dig up all the bad things you've ever buried?
Anything I tell you, it'll go for good.
This is a deathbed tape from a man who witnessed a crime so appalling that he wants us to dig it up.
You know what you should have to do? Put a ticket digger and dig it up.
We're Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor. And from BBC Radio 4, this is Buried, the story of the secret dumping of a million tonnes of waste near a UK city.
We're sitting on a ticking time bomb.
All I kept saying to me was, there's cover-ups.
Subscribe now to Buried on BBC Sounds.